everybody, and welcome into the best in true crime radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader, who will be joining us for Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals here as we get through with the interview portion of the program. That'll be happening here in a little while. I want to introduce our guest first. We have an exciting program here that we'll get to in just a moment, but I want to remind you that through now until the end of the year, we do have a contest going on that we want to encourage people to sign up for. Of course, if you're a member of our Patreon page or our Patreon group here, if you sign up from now until the end of the year, you're eligible to win $500 of what Dave claims is my money, which I don't mind. It's my 401k, and it's all I've earned in radio from for the last 25 years. But it's all yours if you stay with us from now until the end of the year. but you're eligible to win $500 for being a member of True Crime Tuesday. And you just stay a member from now until... Oh, of course, we'd like you to be a member from now until the end of time, but just give us a try from now through the beginning of the year, and everybody who's a member of True Crime Tuesday is eligible and has their name thrown in a hat to win that $500. So if you're a member now of True Crime Tuesday, you're eligible to win that $500, so congratulations. So just stay with us through the beginning of the year. And you are eligible. So we're happy to have you aboard as a member of the True Crime Tuesday family. Also, keep looking for different promotions and different giveaways that we'll be doing throughout next year through 2019 as part of True Crime Tuesday. We're happy to have you aboard, and we're going to be trying some new elements, too, in True Crime Tuesday, not just dumb crimes and stupid criminals and I Knew a Murderer, but we're going to try some other different elements and different suggestions. And if you have a suggestion that you'd like to hear on True Crime Tuesday, just email Dave at darknessradio.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions and feedback on the show, and we're always eager to try some new stuff as well. Let's get into today's program, shall we? We've got an interesting one. You know, we like to, on occasion, and with the genesis of True Crime Tuesday, it started out as a program of true crime that mixed in paranormal elements. Well, Anna Hill is with us today, and she is a true crime enthusiast who researches and blogs about historical crimes, along with her partner, Amber Bankhead, who's not with us today, unfortunately, because of illness, but Anna is here with us today. They created the Deviation Diaries, which is a travel blog about the strange, the taboo, and the macabre, and they've taken special interest in the victims of the Juan Corona murders, who until recently were relatively unknown to most. And they have worked vehemently to humanize them by putting faces in stories to the names behind the murders. Let's welcome to True Crime Tuesday, Anna Hill. Hi, Anna. How are you today?
I'm great, Tim. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is not just a serial killer, but a huge serial killer. Juan Corona was actually a huge serial killer in Mexico, correct? Give us a little bit of background on Juan Corona, a Mexican serial killer, and give us a little bit of the background of Juan Corona.
Actually, Juan Corona is a serial killer here in Northern California.
Oh, Northern California.
Okay. Yeah, he was born in Mexico, but the bulk of his crimes occurred in Yuba City. Actually, all of his crimes that we know of happened in Yuba City, California, which is local to where I'm at.
Okay.
He had at one point the highest kill count. I know there's another killer that doesn't get named very often who actually beat his kill count, but John Wayne Gacy is the one who in headlines kind of took over. Juan is known for killing 25 migrant field workers, but we believe that his kill count is much higher. We live in a very small town. And I don't think that our police force had the manpower to continue looking for bodies. He is known as the machete killer because he hired these men to come work in the orchards for him. And he used a machete to maim and kill these guys. And their bodies were found strung throughout orchards in the Yuba City area. They They found 25 and they felt that there was much more, but they didn't know exactly when and where to stop looking because a few bodies were found miles away. So we really don't know how many people he's killed. He may, in fact, have the highest kill count, but we have no way to prove it.
Let's backtrack a little bit first. Tell me a little bit what his life was like before he reached this infamy of becoming this monster. What was he like? What was he married? Did he have kids? How did he establish this farm? What was his upbringing like?
Well, his background is actually what's interesting about him is because he was known to be a family man. He was born in Mexico. His brother came here to the Yuba Center area. We are a very agricultural area, mm-hmm. So there's a lot of work here. And his brother came here, and I guess Juan was having some problems. Like he was an alcoholic, and so his brother Natividad talked him into coming to Yuba Center area to find work, and he did that. And when he came here, not too long after, I believe Juan was 19 years old, we had the 1955 floods, which were prolific floods. They're in history. They're in United States history. And during that time, Juan had some type of mental breakdown. I'm guessing that he probably had some underlying issues before the floods of 1955. But he saw the flood waters completely devastate our area. And he, in his own mind, believed that nobody survived the floods. And what he was actually witnessing when he was seeing survivors is he thought he was seeing the ghost of the people who had been consumed by the floodwaters. And so after some time had passed, he kept talking about visions and things that he was seeing. His brother had him committed to DeWitt Hospital in Auburn, California, where he underwent, I believe, 23 shock treatment sessions where they did it. And back then it was much more violent of an act than what they have nowadays. There was no anesthesia involved, no kind of sedation. They just shocked him and deemed him cured. I believe his diagnosis was that he was a schizophrenic. And so they deemed him completely cured, sent him back to the Yuba Center area. His brother tried to convince him to go back to Mexico, but Juan stayed here. And actually, if I remember correctly, I think he actually did go home, but came back again. He enjoyed being here in the area, despite the horrible things that in his mind were true, which he thought he was living in a land of ghosts up here. He came back to the Yuba Center area where he ended up, his brother owned a bar in the city of Marysville, and he was a known homosexual gentleman that had a lot of gay men would stay at the bar at late hours of the night, and they say that Juan had bisexual tendencies, but that he became enraged by gay men. I don't know if it was him feeling some sort of shame in his own sexuality, but he would lash out at gay men in the area. And so one night, it was a February of 1971, we believe he attacked a man named Jose Rea and with a machete in the men's bathroom. And many people believe, including my partner, believes that Natividad was actually responsible for that crime, but it kind of sat forth a series of events that led to the murders, which were discovered just a few months later. But that's pretty much his background.
So is it intimated then that maybe there was a bit of self-loathing or self-hate having to do with the sexuality that might have tipped off some of these murders? Or is it more so the mental illness? When you take a look at his history of crime, do you believe it was six of one, half dozen of the other? Or what is it that you feel really touched off his murder spree?
I believe it's a culmination, personally. I mean, if you're unstable and then you've got, you know, because we live in different times as well. We have to imagine the 70s in a small town area. I'm sure that was highly frowned upon. Our area was very prejudiced against other people. excuse me, and the men that ended up being his victims, which were all vagrants, our community handled their passing very poorly. They wanted to sweep these murders under the rug. They wanted to act like it wasn't happening. They wanted it to be hush-hush, but it turned out to be national news.
All right. So you have that first victim that you mentioned there, but what do we know about these victims other than their supposed sexual identities? I mean, were all these victims supposedly gay men, or was he indiscriminate? Were these just the fact that they had worked for him, or was he indiscriminate about his victims? Did he just decide that they didn't necessarily have to work for him, or was it convenient that they weren't attached to families? Did he have an MO here that he decided that he was going to pick his victims by?
He was very particular about the people that he picked. So one worked for Jack Sullivan, who owned the Sullivan Ranch. It's near Live Oak, California. It's just on the outskirts of Yuba City. And he was a farmhand for Sullivan. Juan was known to be a very hard worker. He was he had a very good reputation in town as being somebody who would, you know, get a job load. Let's say that he was thinning peaches during peach harvest, and he would go around to the local parks and pick up gentlemen that were searching for work. At that point in time, men were coming over on trains to seek work here, seasonal work in California, because the harvests were so good. So he would drive to these parks, and most of the men that he picked up were what at the time was considered a wino or a fruit tramp. Most of the men had drinking problems. They were vulnerable. Most of them wouldn't turn down work. So he was able to pick them up, take them out to these locations that were very secluded, and incapacitate them by taking a machete and hacking them about the bottom of the head, just enough just to disable them. And most every one of these men had their pants pulled down around their ankles. There's been some dispute whether or not these crimes were sexually driven or not. But after the research I've done, I have the tendency to lean towards whoever did this was a sexual sadist of some sort, of some degree. I guess I felt a lot of compassion for these men that were killed, because our area did treat them like they were subhuman. And in my eyes, they were men that had problems, but they were, you know, ultimately killed because they were seeking work. He would hire them to dig holes in the orchards to, quote unquote, bury garbage. And essentially what they were doing is digging their own graves.
Oh my gosh. That is grisly indeed.
It is.
With these victims, I'm curious too, Anna. With these victims, was there anybody who ever really came forward? I know you said that they were kind of brushed aside and the town didn't think much of them, but was there really anybody who came forward and said, you know, this is my loved one and I'm concerned about them and whatever happened to them? Was there anybody who really championed them or wanted to know what happened to their missing loved ones? Was there really anybody who came forward?
There was 25 found victims, and out of those, 14 of them were buried in a local cemetery because at the time they were unclaimed.
Okay.
So the rest of the men were claimed by family. There's been some argument that not all of them were considered homeless, but that they wandered by choice, not because they didn't have family. The 14 that were buried within the cemetery at the time, they were unknown, or they knew their identity but had no way to get a hold of family. Some of those family members came forward later and said, yes, this is my brother, this is my nephew, or whatever, but they didn't have the funds at the time to remove those bodies. I'm trying to think of an exact number, but I'm not sure. It's in our blog, but how many men were left unclaimed. I believe to this date, even though the tombstone may say different, I believe there's only three that are unknowns. The rest have a name attached to them. I would say, let's see, 11 of them have gone to be buried with family and family plots. So it's kind of a mixed bunch.
Now, I'm interested in Juan Corona's standing in the community. I mean, obviously, this man came along enough to be able to own an orchard in the community. So obviously, he's got quite a bit of land. I guess I want to backtrack a little bit here. And how did he acquire so much land, or what had happened that he had gotten that much land?
He actually didn't own any of the land. It was Jack Sullivan's ranch is the ranch that these bodies were found on. He was like a, I guess, what would you call it? Like a contractor. He is the one they would go, okay, Juan, we have, you know, 2 acres of peaches that we need to have thinned. And he would hire indiscriminately whoever he wanted. He would be given pay for a certain amount of work to be done. And then he would delegate payment out to, you know, men who worked under him. So really, he pick and chose how much to pay these people. And a lot of them, from my understanding, worked just to have a place to stay for the night and a hot meal. He had a bunkhouse on the property that the men stayed at. And he would offer them, you know, food or whatever. And I, you know, I'm sure beer or whatever else they needed to get through the workday. So to these guys, you know, a little bit of money in the pocket and a place to sleep for the night and a hot meal was enough reason to find work. And there's many men who worked for him that, you know, were never hurt. So they thought that while he was kind of like a, I don't know if I can say the word, but, you know, a hard butt, a tough guy, he paid people and he was kind of doing a service to people. But then in the summer of 1970, something happened that he started taking this anger out on people. And like I was saying earlier, there's some, it's kind of a split crowd. Some people believe that his brother was the one who actually committed these murders because he, because, of course, they knew he was a homosexual man, and he had problems of his own as well. He had some mental issues as well. But in my opinion, I think there's a chance that they may have worked together to try to cover up these crimes. But I definitely do not believe that Juan, by any stretch of the means, was a innocent player. I believe that he's as guilty as anybody.
So you say that there might have been some conspiracy to try and cover this up. What indicators did you have in your research that might have led you to believe that there might have been some conspiracy to help him cover that up?
Well, with the original crime, the gentleman that was just maimed at the restaurant in Marysville, that gentleman actually sued the brother, Natividad Corona, for, I can't remember the exact charge, but it has something to do with you know, that act happening to him while in his place of business. Natividad lost that lawsuit and he fled to Mexico immediately. The when Juan Corona was being investigated, they found a ledger in his home containing 30 names of gentlemen with dates that correlated to this time period, including Jose Reya and the date that he was maimed, which I believe was February 25th, 1970. And then names of the various victims that we're talking about that were found in the grave, they also are on that ledger. And we have really no idea because at that point in time, the medical technology wasn't there, like I said before. Mm-hmm. Our town was not prepared to handle this type of crime. So the doctor that actually did the autopsies on the body was just an average physician. A medical examiner never touched the bodies. So we really don't know what state of decomp these bodies were in or when they passed away. But for him to flee to Mexico suddenly draws a lot of curiosity into why he felt the need to flee so suddenly, even if everybody already thought that his brother Juan was guilty for these crimes. The fact that Juan was able to fool so many people and get them out to the orchards to move the bodies, and it just was very elaborate in the way, because there were so many men on the property where the orchards were, that he was able to pull off so many murders in just such a short amount of time is nearly inconceivable. It makes sense that he may have had some kind of help to pull that off.
Now, I'm going to ask you here to speculate a little bit in that the amount of shock treatment he received before he even started this murder spree. I'm going to ask you a little bit about physical changes of the brain. And this is why. And I'm going to ask you about his history before, and I don't know if you're aware of it or not, or how much research you've done on it, but did he show a tendency before the shock treatments to have this murderous rage as opposed to afterwards?
I know that he has always had a temper. He had a temper long before, but I have seen nothing to indicate that he had a murderous rage about him until the floods of 1955, which would have been within months to weeks of the DeWitt hospital visit where he received those shots.
I guess what keeps running through my mind is that with the and we don't, I guess we have more scientific knowledge now. We have more data as to what shock treatment does to the brain and how it affects the brain. It just seems to me that with the amount of current going through the brain and the amount of damage done to the brain with the shock treatment, you would think that would somehow change at least the way the brain would operate, the electrical signals that being sent through the brain. Something would have to have had happened to him where something just would change, especially with his rages.
I totally agree.
Push him a little further. Because it seems to me that things got more intense with him after those shock treatments, his behavior became more, I guess, extreme.
It definitely did. And the way they handled shock treatments back then was not the same as it is now. I have a close family member who has received shock treatments as of recently, and they're relatively non-traumatic. Mm-hmm. They'll sedate you. The way they handle it in general is just different. Back then, there was a continuous notation in his history that he was not sedated. There was no anesthesia involved, which I'm not sure that anesthesia would be the correct word. I'm imagining they mean like sedation. Mm-hmm. He would have been tied down. It would have been, if anything, even if the electrical current didn't necessarily extremely change the dynamic of how his brain fired, I'm sure he was very traumatized by the situation.
Okay.
And you take somebody who's already unstable and you put them through something that traumatic, who knows what can happen?
Yeah, I just, and don't get me wrong, I'm not taking the blame off of Juan Corona to say that none of this was his fault. It's just that to me, it would seem that this was just aggravating a situation that was probably already volatile. There was probably already the let's just say it was underlying already, that maybe the seed was already there for this to happen or for him to want to kill. But maybe this drew it out a little bit. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I believe it exasperated the situation for sure.
That's a good way of putting it.
I think mental illness at that time was very, what's the word for it? Taboo. It was hush hush. People talked about mental illness like where nowadays we have mental illnesses talked about. Everybody has a mental illness nowadays. Back then, you did not want to be associated with something like that. And schizophrenia, to me, if that's even the correct diagnosis, I think is a very misunderstood condition of the brain. I mean, for a doctor to say that he was cured and he was set free because he had received all these shocks already tells me that the medical side of things were lacking.
Do you think that there are any more than the 25 that are attributed to him? Do you think that maybe there are more victims in his past that maybe just haven't come out?
Absolutely. I have no doubt whatsoever. In the blog that I cover the victims of the crime. At the bottom, I made some notations that some other bodies that were discovered in Tehama County and several miles away, but close enough that, you know, if something were to happen in our area, the Yuba Center area, that it's only an hour drive away. I mean, it's manageable that he could have left for the evening, said he was going to the orchards and took a drive up to Tehama County, dumped somebody and came back. At that point in time, these crimes were a blemish to the community. They wanted to stop talking about what was going on. We live in the Yuba Center area, which is essentially Marysville and Yuba City. And the two cities were actually fighting for who was to blame for these crimes. We had Yuba City, where the killer resided and was from, and then we had Marysville, where all the quote-unquote, not my words, drunks were from. Mm-hmm. And so Yuba City wanted to say, well, Marysville is the place with all the, you know, the debauchery and the loose women and the drunks and the homeless people. And then Yuba City's like, well, or I'm sorry, Marysville's like, well, Yuba City, you guys are the ones who bred a serial killer. So when they found the 25 and they tore the orchard apart, they couldn't find any more bodies there. They were like, okay, well, you know, he's being tried for 25 murders. We're going to make this a capital punishment case. We're going to go for the death sentence. You can only kill a guy so many times. I think 25 times is enough times to kill this man.
Yeah.
But of course, as I'm sure you know, as a crime fan as well, they abolished the death penalty between that time. He went to trial in 1973. So it's literally the year that saved everybody. We're talking about from Juan Corona to the Manson trial, all these prolific crimes that happened in California, all these, the reason why we have so many living serial killers in our judicial system is because at that point in time, we did not have capital punishment to, you know, to throw out death sentences for these guys. But I have zero doubts that there are many more victims out there. That's why I say that he very well could have more numbers than even Gacy.
If you had to put a number on it, in your estimation, how many more do you think are out there?
I couldn't even begin to imagine. I'm at 25, and I believe there in my blog there's an additional 4 or 5. That would be 30. I would say at least 50.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, it's pretty wild. There was a lot of men that came up missing at that time too, but because of their social status, nobody looked for them. They just figured they just hopped on the next train down to Modesto to work the next crop or whatever. But there's families that have drawn together with the victims of this crime that are still to this day have no idea what happened to their brothers or uncles or fathers.
So there are still bodies out there. There are still some loose ends to wrap up as far as what the victims of Juan Corona, let's start with this first. When Juan Corona, it's hard for me to form words, when Juan Corona was doing what he was doing, what was his eventual downfall? How did he get caught? I mean, obviously it's an easy machination to lure in workers that supposedly don't have a lot of ties, do what it is you're doing, and get rid of them if they, you know, if they're so supposed, and I hate using the word, but I'll use it, if they're drunks or if they're vagrants or if they're, you know, they don't have the family ties. And if you can get rid of them quickly without those ties, well, then supposedly there's no loose ends. But there had to be somewhere in there where Juan Corona gets tripped up. And what was that one point where he got tripped up?
Putting too many bodies in one orchard and hiring too many hands that were efficient. The two properties, okay, so we had Jack Sullivan's property and another gentleman. I'm not even going to attempt his name because it's, I believe he's Japanese. It's a name, if I say it over the air, I'm going to slay it. It's just not going to come out right.
Okay.
But he discovered somebody had been digging holes on his property.
Uh-huh.
And so he called the police out and, you know, there were some empty holes. So there was there was other holes that were already pre-dug that didn't even have a body in it yet. So he was not finished. He was going to continue. So the sheriff's department comes out and they look at the holes, and then another worker on the Sullivan Ranch goes, well, you know, we've been noticing some holes that are happening over here. And of course they start turning up holes, and guess what they find? They're finding dead bodies all over the place. Juan did not hide that he was with these men. Everybody knew that he was going to town hiring hands. So the guys that worked the orchards knew each other. So when they were actually pulling people out of the graves, they're like, oh, that's Kenneth Whitaker. This is John Marzak. This, you know, on and on and on. And so he was placed with them. Essentially, he just was sloppy. I don't think he ever thought that he was going to get caught. He kind of ran things out there. I think it wasn't even on the radar for him. As far as bodies and kill counts, something else I was going to add is that this orchard runs along a river. Some of the little groupings of graves were down near the river, so you would imagine it had been like sand and things. So they weren't buried very deep, but through the years, since 1971, occasionally in the river behind that ranch, they do find skulls, but many of them are Native American, because we live in a plains area where we had the tribes of the Maidu Indians. But, you know, it's not unusual for banks to wash out and things to wash down the river. So if he was burying people right at the bank's edge, they could be miles down the Feather River right now. We wouldn't even know that they were there. They would sink to the bottom, you know, go down with the riverbed. So there's just so many things that happened with this case that I just don't think the world's ever going to really know. Between the socioeconomic population that he targeted to the geography of where he buried people, I think that it's one of those types of crimes that we're never going to have complete answers to.
So you could almost say, it's almost fair to say that he might have been thinking ahead and thinking, if I bury these bodies close to the river, that eventually they might just, if they do end up washing away, they'll wash away down the river, come up down the river, and people will think they're just Indian remains.
You know, I thought about that, but the only thing that keeps me from completely believing that is the fact that he did bury two bodies. Okay, so this is on Highway 99. This is on the east side of Highway 99. On the west side of Highway 99, there's also two burial sites where they're completely away from the river. I don't know why he did that. I don't know if it was just a matter of convenience, but I don't know. It's one of those things that really intrigues me. I can't get inside his head. I've tried.
Huh. So there wasn't one constant MO to getting rid of the bodies either.
No, not as far as disposing of them. Of course, he buried everybody that we know of. Who knows if he's tried anything else? All of the murders except one were all machete murders. One person he actually did shoot. They found a bullet wound. I'm not sure which victim exactly that was or what the circumstances were, but he was shot in the head.
Interesting. As you know, from studying this stuff, normally there's a consistent MO to not only to how the murders are committed, but generally how the bodies are disposed of. So to be, and he's not necessarily all over the place, but to be differing how he does things, or even to be sloppy about things, would suggest not only the mental illness part of it, but see, this is what's intriguing about this case. There are times of, you can see there are times of lucidity in that he does things a certain way, like the machete part of the murders for the majority of them, but then he strays. Or the way he disposes of the bodies, but then he strays. Which suggests almost an unraveling at times.
I think he was unraveled from the gate. I just can't see at any point in time that any of this was ever really truly well thought out. As I mentioned earlier, he was a family man. He was, I mean, people who heard that Juan Corona was arrested for these crimes did not believe it. To this day, as local bloggers who talk about this case, we still have family members and friends of the Corona family, which I'm going to tell you, they're great people. We haven't had any kind of problem. Everybody's been real supportive, but there is a very strong support system that Juan Corona is an innocent man. They, for the 1970s, they claimed that he was kind of like a pawn. Sutter County chose him because he was Mexican. No other reason than racial discrimination. He went to church every single Sunday. The parishioners all supported the Corona family, including Juan. They did a service for the gentleman who were killed at his church, and the sermon actually revolved more around being sympathetic to the Corona family and what they were going through versus what had transpired for the men themselves. So if not Juan,
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but if not Juan Corona, then who? If the people that are defending Juan Corona don't think it was him, then who do they suggest did these murders?
Natividad. They believe that the brother was guilty. So I don't really understand why they chose Natividad over Juan, but my understanding is that before this time, there was some tension between the Corona family and Natividad. That's why Natividad was here. Juan has young daughters at that time, very young girls, and so they still live here in the Yuba Center area. It's hard to approach this case with extreme bias on our behalves when we can understand both sides of the situation, because it's really just one of those things that we will never have answers to. Juan is still incarcerated. He's in which jail is it? Corcoran? At Corcoran, but he has severe dementia, so we'll never get an answer out of him. Although in 2011, he did allude to the fact that the reason why the men were killed is because they were winos and they were trespassing.
But even so, if he has dementia, can you totally depend on that, on what he said?
Yeah, well, I think the dementia, if anything, I think it caused him to be less careful about what he was saying. But at that time when he made his confession, he, I think, was lucid enough that he knew what he was saying. But at the same time, his guard was down just enough for him to go ahead and, you know, kind of blurt out the reasoning. And it was at his parole hearing that he said that.
Oh, okay. So let's backtrack a little bit here. So Juan had made his mistake, and we talked about that, where there were too many bodies in those holes. So how is it they determined that it was Juan that had put the bodies in the hole, and that it was not his brother or somebody else? How is it that they pointed the finger at Juan and eventually arrested him?
It was just witnesses saying that, oh yeah, I saw, you know, X, Y, and Z in the back pickup truck of Juan Corona's truck, and the ledger that they found in his home. He has a very famous, everybody knows Juan Corona's van in this area. He had a white Chevy van that had DNA in it or blood. I don't even know how involved the DNA was at that time, but there was blood, human blood, in all over his van, and as well as that's where they found the machete. But his claim was that, well, I had workers and we were busty knuckles every day, and of course you're going to find their blood. I mean, I hired them. They were in my van all week long, and oh, you know, this man cut his finger doing this and this, and the machete, well, that was used, you know, we used it for working too, so of course you're going to find blood. But the evidence was pretty overwhelming, but I think it really came down to what people in the town were saying, witnesses saying that they had seen Juan frequently picking people up, that he had a really horrible temper, and the fact that Sutter County wanted it to go away as soon as possible. The sooner they got a conviction, the sooner they could put it behind them. But instead, this trial lasted quite some time, and it became national news, as I've said. But what intrigued me about this case the most is that in our town, anytime we bring up Juan Corona, every single person that we've spoke to has a story of how they either knew him, they knew a victim, their grandfather, dad, brother were the arresting officers, the attorneys, everybody all across the board. We have these people following our page, and we're just constantly digging, trying to find more information to make these poor men who had such an injustice in life receive such an injustice in death, and they became less than human when they had died. Nobody wanted to mourn them. Everybody wanted to put them back in a hole, close the hole up and forget that this ever existed. So for me, it was really important to show the fact that each one of these men had a story. They had families before they became homeless. They had something. Many of these were vets. We had, I can't even give you a number off the top of my head, but many of these guys served as combat vets. And, you know, they, regardless of whatever their situation was at the time of death, they deserve to be known that, hey, I was here.
And in that, in bringing out their recognition, the recognition of what they did, have you been able to reconnect those names with different families, or have you been able to reconnect people with those loved ones?
Not necessarily on that level, but what I was able to do is on the internet, I began researching this, and I found some pictures of some of the victims. I went through newspaper archives and different routes to obtain those, but a lot of them didn't have names attached to them. And then on the flip side, in the books that you read about them, there were names, but there were no faces. So each one, I began to break them down and try to find out who each one of them was and to was, were. I haven't had enough coffee today. Sorry about that. to, you know, just to put them together so that it was a human that was killed. Many people thought because they were migrant field workers that they were all Mexican gentlemen that were killed, which wouldn't be any less tragic, but regardless, I just wanted the facts to be out there about what each man had accomplished in his life, his downfalls, his family, his name, his birthday, whatever information I could get on each one of these guys. I just pulled it from all types of sources and just tried to compile it into one database. And even as today, the blog that I have all the victims' information, it's kind of a hot mess. It needs to be organized a little bit better, but the information is there. And I'm really proud of it. I'm really proud that I was able to take the time and just put everything together so that these guys, you know, had a face and they weren't just a name in the paper or the fruit tramps or the drunks or whatever they were trying to say. There was some family members of the DA that actually approached me. The DA who tried this case, he actually has since passed away, but his daughter reached out to me and said, you know, I just wanted to tell you, my dad would be so proud to know that somebody cared. And it's only taken, 40 something years for somebody just to give a damn, just to shove it together and say, hey, these guys were human. They weren't just a name in the paper.
Which is, yeah, very, very admirable. It's kind of hit me as you're describing this process. So what kind of effort, and I got to ask you, what kind of effort does it take to actually get a picture of a man who, let's say, came from Mexico? Because we have to think about this too, especially a man that came from Mexico in the early 70s. Or even late 60s, early 70s. What kind of effort does that take? I can imagine it's a huge undertaking to try and find even just a picture of a person that came from Mexico. Just the rooting around, the searching, the trying to get any information whatsoever, even if it's a picture, a scrap of information, whatever it is, to try and flesh out, like you said, more than just a name for one person, much less to try and do it for all 25. I got to imagine that's a Herculean effort.
The photos were there simply because the fact that most of these guys had a record. Most of them had mugshots available. Where the complication arose for me is that I'm sure that their faces and their names are put together somewhere. It's probably in Oakland or San Francisco in an archive somewhere. I believe some of the pictures that I found said Alameda on them, so I'm imagining there's some sort of like kind of like the Library of Congress type thing. The pictures were available, but they had absolutely no names attached to them whatsoever. I think maybe out of the, I don't even have 25 pictures. I think I have 22 pictures. Out of those 22, I think maybe at most 10 guys actually had a name attached. Even then, some of them were mislabeled, and I had to go back, or a family member or a friend or somebody who knew the man would be like, oh, this is my uncle. This is blah, blah, blah. And I would realize there was something conflicting about the information that I had even received. But at that time, there was no digital database for these things. So they were thrown in a box and things get kind of screwed up. So unless somebody actually physically could say, no, that was Mark Beverly or whoever, it was kind of like a shot in the dark. And the last thing I wanted to do was mislabel a man and say that, you know, this is Jerome Kelly, and it turns out to be another gentleman. The last man that I was actually able to identify actually came on a fluke. I bought a subscription to the New York Times because I was just looking at Juan Corona articles, and I noticed that there was a picture of some of the victims, but it was blurred out. So I went ahead and purchased the subscription. And I was able to identify one of the black gentlemen that I had been reading about for months and months. And I was finally able to see his face. And I actually called Amber, and I was actually crying because I just couldn't believe that I had found this man. I was so overwhelmed with gratitude that I found this little tiny piece of information concerning this man. Even if it was just his face, and I really don't have any other information on him, but it was just like, literally, like he just said, "Hey, hi, you know, I appreciate what you're doing." It was really emotional for me. And just to clear the record, the gentleman that were killed, there was two African American gentlemen, an Indian gentleman who was from a Maidu tribe here in the Oroville area, and the rest were all Caucasian gentlemen.
Interesting. Well, let me ask you this now. So there is a twist in Juan Corona's conviction. Initially, he's convicted, but then that conviction is overturned. How did that happen?
An overturned conviction? I don't know of an overturned conviction. He actually went to trial, and he did go back later on for some other things, but from the gate, he was charged with 25 consecutive life sentences to death. Or, I'm sorry, to life, not death.
Okay. Because it's at least what I'm reading here. He had a second trial, right?
He did, but okay. I'm not sure exactly. I'm trying to remember exactly how that all went down, but I'm not, honestly, I don't want to misspeak and give the wrong information.
Okay. So he's got these 25 life sentences, and I believe the way it plays out is he's eligible for parole again now in 2021, although he's had plenty of shots at parole and, of course, hasn't been paroled.
Right. His last one was, I believe, in November of 2016. Mm-hmm. His brother was trying to get him, which is a different brother, Natividad. They don't know what came into Natividad. Supposedly he passed away of syphilis or something like that in Mexico, but there's no proof and there's never been a body, so I don't know. But the other brother is I want to say in Arizona, and because of Juan's deteriorating mental status, he wants to bring him home because he believes that he's no longer a threat to society, but of course it was shot down.
So I would ask you this, and according to what I'm looking at here, he's in what's called the Sensitive Needs Yard, where he is at now in Corcoran State Prison in Corcoran, California.
Mm-hmm.
So I would ask you this, knowing what he has been convicted of and what he's been convicted of doing, at what he's at now, at 87 years old and having dementia and supposedly, according to his relatives, not being a threat, would you grant him parole or would you leave him there for the rest of his life to die?
Yeah, I got Amber here sitting next to me. She's not feeling well, so she's not on air, but she's I'm just going to say for the record, she's nodding her head yes. Me, myself, no. And Amber and I don't agree on all things. That's kind of what I like about our blog is that she has very different views than I do.
Mm-hmm.
In her opinion, yes, she thinks that he should be able to go home because he's essentially no longer the man that he was. As for me, you do the crime, you do the time.
Right on. Okay. So I would ask you then this. With the blog, and let's talk a little bit about the blog now too, because the blog is expanded past this case. If I'm reading
oh
right.
Oh boy, yes, it has. It started with the Juan Corona case because we started as a weird history blog. So of course you don't get much weirder than a homegrown serial killer in your own town, which I will tell you we have two.
Mm-hmm.
Juan is not the only one that we have, and. We started, it kind of grew into whatever it is now because of the people with personal stories that were reaching out to us. Amber and I really pride ourselves in the fact that we cover cold cases. Some of those are from the 60s, 70s, 50s that everybody's forgotten about. People would be like, yeah, you know, my cousin went missing in the 70s and Nobody cares about it. Everybody's forgotten about him. So we would write a blog about it, and it would just spread like wildfire. There was people hitting me up later on like, hey, did you see that blog about the five missing guys from Chico? And I'm like, yeah, I wrote that blog. They're like, wow, that is just a really great blog. We didn't know that you guys were involved in something like that. So cold cases have become another facet of our blog that Amber and I are both really proud of. We do current cases as well as old, you know, quote unquote, historical cases as well.
So with the Deviation Diaries, is it just the reporting of these cold cases or is it putting a face to like with the Juan Corona case, is it putting a face to names or what is it that you're achieving with the Deviation Diaries or hoping to achieve?
All of it.
All of it?
We're just trying to, you know, we don't put a cap or it's hard to explain. We try not to get ourselves binded into one type of information. It's like if a family member comes to us, we're going to help them out. We've had, like I was saying, we have a river. We actually have two rivers that run through our area. So we have a lot of John Doe cases or Jane Doe cases where they find bodies in the river with no names. We will work with the sheriff's department or whoever puts out the information for these cases. We have one on our page that's been there since April. It's a deceased gentleman's tattoos, you know, sharing those information with the general public. It's definitely changed the way our area views crime. Even our local newspaper has started picking up cold cases and talking about them in the paper. And I know it's because Amber and I stepped up to the plate and said, you know, Yuba County and Sutter County have way too many unsolved cases. Let's get these cases back out there so we can, you know, try to give some closure to some of these families. And, you know, a lot of the mothers and fathers of these kids that have gone missing and everything have passed away and they have never seen justice for their families. But in a way, we're giving some of that back by giving the families a platform to speak. If they want to post their loved one's story, they give us the information, I write the story, and Amber and I put it on our page. And, you know, it gives them some sort of I don't know what the word is, a solace that people still care. I think that's kind of what our mantra is that we just want to show our community that we still care.
So I'm going to ask you kind of a different question in that, do you feel that the blog has helped your local law enforcement or put heat on your local law enforcement by exposing all these different cases out there, that even the cold cases or the new missing people cases that are out there? Do you feel that it's shown a light on them as being inefficient, or that it said or helped them by saying, you know, putting more eyes out there on the streets as far as looking out for these missing people?
We've got nothing but good feedback from our local law enforcement agencies, which in our two towns, we have four different agencies. We have Yuba and Sutter County Sheriff's Departments, Yuba City PD, and Marysville PD. Amber and I, both between the two of us, we do know some people that work within those law enforcement agencies, and they're just like, oh, you guys are the girls that keep sharing our cold cases. Thank you for doing that. Or the John Doe with the tattoos. Amber is neighbors with the head detective on that case. And he's like, oh, you girls are the ones that keep sharing my John Doe. We really appreciate it. And he'd give us little, you know, Easter eggs that like, oh, well, you know, let me let you know about this too. You know, about like he was dressed in women's clothing, the newspaper said, but that it wasn't exactly accurate, but we were able to put out the right information. So besides the history, we have history buffs that follow our page, but we also have people that are just they depend on us in a way to report the correct information. People just, I don't know why, just all of a sudden people come to us for anything related to murder or John Doe cases or unsolved cases and that sort of thing.
Well, that's actually pretty cool. I mean, you know, the fact that you've become a source now for, I mean, not only for local law enforcement, but for the community as well. I mean, it's kind of nice that you can be that go-between between both.
We're honored to do it. I mean, it's slowed down a little bit because in the last year, Amber and I have made some career changes that have kind of hindered our ability to spend so much time on research. But it's been a pleasure to have be able to have that role for our community. It's been good for both of us.
Is there a case right now, as far as the deviation diaries go, that both you and Amber are kind of both hot on the trail of, that really, I guess, you're close to cracking, or that you and law enforcement are close to cracking, or the community that you really feel that, I guess that you're close to breaking?
I don't know that we're close to breaking, but the tattoo John Doe is definitely one that, I don't know when it happened or how it happened, but we became that gentleman's spokesman in sort of a way. People come to us to find updates on that John Doe because it's something that's really enthralled our community.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, so in April, we had a gentleman. We have two sister bridges. He washed up underneath one of the bridges. He had female underwear on. They didn't know if he was a male or female because his body was in such advanced stages of decomp that they didn't know who he was. We live next to two major rivers, and so we don't know if he came from our community or upstream near Oroville or what, but we have had a lot of men showing up in our river the last couple years. People have speculated that maybe we have another serial killer, but Amber and I are not ready to jump on that train just yet because we don't want to, speculate right now. But he was found and he had tattoos. I believe that they were on his forearms, but I'm not 100% sure. One was a USAF sheepdog, which is very symbolic for military as well as law enforcement. A sheepdog watches over the herd. And then the other one was an ambigram that said faith. What was it, Amber? Faith and hope. When you flipped it back and forth, one way it would read faith, the other way it was hope. So We don't know why he had female underwear on, but he did. And the way he was, how can I say this and be delicate? His male parts were tucked back. Okay. But we don't know if that was the force of the river. But when they were just looking at him at first glance, they thought that he was a female until they had closer inspection. His arms and things were in good shape, but his face and body were not. So it was very hard for them to try to get any type of fingerprints that matched any type of databases. They did try DNA and things like that, dental impressions, no matches across the board. And they've also checked with our local tattoo shops, which in our area, there is a plethora of tattoo shops, but they've just gotten nothing. So I suspect that he may be from outside the area. We do live within 10 miles of Beale Air Force Base, okay. Actually even closer than that. So it could be an airman. I don't know. Hmm. It's hard to say.
Gosh. Well, we wish you the best of luck on that, and hopefully they find some leads here soon on that. And if people want to check out the Deviation Diaries, that blog that you have, how do they do so? How do they check out the blog?
The best chance is to find us on Facebook. It's simply The Deviation Diaries. We also have two branches, one in Cincinnati and another one on the East Coast. Some gals have started pages out there because they love what we do. But you'll see the little orange logo that is Amber and I work, kind of the mother page. And you can go to thedeviationdiaries.blogspot.com. That's where we have our blog. And by the same name, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter as well.
So this begs an interesting question now, Anna, and I guess throw it out to Amber, too, if she's in the background listening. Does this mean that you would be open to franchising the Deviation Diaries if you've done this with one or two other chapters?
No.
No? Okay.
No. I've been in many teams where we've tried to do things like that, and I think we're just going to keep it small. If people wanted to, let's say they really enjoyed what we do, we mm-hmm. welcome people to go ahead and take the name, do your own thing. We're proud of what we do, but we're always going to be – it's always going to be our page. I can't ever see us expanding. We like to keep it small. We like to keep it community-based, even though we've branched out to California, Nevada as well. I think if we let it grow too big, I think that we would lose the part of us that's in it. We would lose the human factor, and that's not something we're prepared to do. And Amber's nodding her head the entire time, so
okay,
she's with me.
Because it's, I mean, what you're doing is very important. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of times, especially with the local news or whatever it is, they shine the initial light on a missing person's case, or even with different shows on television, on true crime television, or even programs like this, we shine the initial light on a case, and then it kind of goes away.
Oh, yeah. There's always something bigger and better to work on, whatever will bring ratings.
Right. But in the work that you do, and it's great work that you do, you continue to shine that light on that case, and you continue to follow up, and you continue to do the yeoman's work of getting behind that case until it's eventually solved. And that's very admirable and admirable work. It's and that's what's important about that type of work, is that you are kind of the wind beneath the sails of law enforcement, and that even they have to put down the gauntlet of a cold case every once in a while and keep continuing to move. And it's important to, especially with our audience, to remind them that, you know, that blogs like yours and Amber's are out there, that to keep reminding people that, hey, these cold cases do exist out there, and every once in a while they do need a shot of adrenaline, and that there are people out there that are forgotten, but they're not meant to be forgotten, that the Deviation Diaries and blogs like that are out there.
I appreciate that. That's really nice of you to say that. You know, we have gotten just some outstanding feedback, and it is a labor of love. It's you know, there's no other reason for us to do it, other than if it was our family member. We would want people to care, and we want to show our community that we care about what happens to them, and being a voice for the voiceless, to me, is one of the most heroic things that you could do for somebody else.
Well, we appreciate what you and Amber are doing, Anna, and we thank you both for being on the program today on True Crime Tuesday. Again, tell people how they can find the Deviation Diaries.
You can just come over to Facebook and find us at the Deviation Diaries, and on Instagram, Twitter, anything, just Google us and you will find us.
All right. Well, we wish Amber the best, and we hope she gets well soon. And thank you, Anna, for being with us today. We greatly appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. And it's time now for us to turn from the Deviation Diaries and from True Crime Blog to Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News Storytime.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Tim. You know, dumb crimes, stupid criminals, that can be a wide range of things. Sometimes we just think it's funny crimes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've got some disturbing things to talk about to start off. We'll go into some of the funnier stuff later.
Okay.
But there are a few really disturbing stories in the news right now. In the Canadian government, Tim, this is the headline. Killer. Murder I committed has given me PTSD. So Canadian government is paying for treatment of imprisoned killer Christopher Garnier. Christopher Garnier strangled Catherine Campbell to death back in 2015, then dumped her body by a bridge in Halifax, Canada. Now the 30-year-old is serving a life sentence, but he made an unusual and successful plea to the court, reports the CBC. Garnier argued that he now has PTSD as a result of the murder he committed, and the government is paying for his treatment. One more twist, Tim. The bill is being covered by Veterans Affairs Canada, even though Garnier himself is not a vet. His father served in the military, however, and that qualifies him for coverage. I find it really hard to chew on that we're spending taxpayers' money like that to help someone when we also have veterans that are having a really hard time getting treatment through VAC, says a retired sergeant and activist for the veterans' causes. It's the best we can expect in the warm, fuzzy manner of sentencing in Canada, writes the aunt of Campbell, age 36, who was a Halifax police officer. Prison sentences are the only thing I admire that the USA does. Garnier's defense team raised the PTSD during a hearing to determine when he would be up for parole, per the Canadian press. They said the PTSD should be a mitigating factor, and the argument seems to have helped. Well, you know, if he had PTSD before attacking this woman and killing her, Tim, you might have a defense there to say, listen, he's obviously not in his right mind. But then to use the fact that he has PTSD after the fact, because he committed the murder, why should there be any leniency? What am I missing in this story?
It's a good question.
I mean, that they're like, well, yes, we're going to ease up on you because of the PTSD. He brought it on himself. He strangled a woman and murdered her to death. Tim, by the way, murder to death, that's the worst kind.
That is, yeah.
Yeah. Garnier is now eligible for parole in about 13 years. On the low side of the 10 to 25-year range, he maintains that he killed Campbell accidentally during rough sex after they'd met at a bar. The message should be sent that Mr. Garnier should forever be remembered as the person who stole Ms. Campbell's future for no reason and then treated her remains like garbage, said the prosecutors. Oh, he's got PTSD from murdering, Tim. The poor guy. Let's send him some love, Tim. Love in the shape of my boot in his ass. Sorry, I'm not very kind right now, am I?
No.
Am I wrong, though? That just seems weird to me, man. Seems weird. Now, here's a very upsetting story. Elizabeth Smart's kidnapper has been unexpectedly released, Tim. Smart's father says the family's been told that Wanda Barzee wouldn't be freed for years. The woman who helped kidnap Elizabeth Smart back in 2002 then held her in captivity for 9 months will be freed next Wednesday following a surprise announcement from the Utah Board of Pardons and Parole. The somewhat confusing development is a technical one. The Salt Lake Tribune is reporting the board denied Wanda Barzee an early release in July, but an official now says that upon further review and advice from legal counsel, the board must count time spent in federal custody towards Ms. Barzee's state sentence. Barzee, 72, served 8 years at a federal prison in Texas. The state charge was related to a separate plot to kidnap Smart's cousin in the weeks after Barzee and husband Brian David Mitchell took Smart. She pleaded guilty to that charge and was sentenced to 1 to 15 years. Smart's father expressed surprise. We were told she was not going to be getting out until 2022. Fox 13, however, reports her release will come 5 years before it was expected she would be eligible for parole, which would have been 2023. Fox News has strong words from Smart herself via statement. It is incomprehensible how someone who has not cooperated with her mental health evaluations or risk assessments and someone who did not show up to her own parole hearing can be released into our community. I'm trying to understand how and why this has happened and exploring possible options. Fox News adds that Mitchell is serving 2 life sentences. Yeah, I wonder what her other options are. Military, hitman. At this point, I would be blown away, Tim. I don't know that woman would survive 48 hours out of prison had she done that to my child.
Yeah.
And then they're going to let her go 5 years early when she didn't even show up to her parole hearing and has other mental issues? So here's a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down, Tim.
Okay.
This is one of those stories I wasn't sure I should. I don't know. It's so bizarre. We'll share it. Just here's the headline. Hubby from hell. A husband skinned his wife like a fish and then had the kids pose with her corpse. A sick dad is on trial for skinning his wife like a fish before having his kids pose for photos with their dead mom's body. Justin Ray, age 36, said he went to such extreme measures in order to keep his family together and that the whole ordeal, it just wasn't fun for me. Oh, gee, I'm sorry skinning your wife and then having your kids pose with her dead body just didn't turn out to be the laughs that you thought it would be. Ray and his 2 kids were found living in a storage unit while his wife Jessica Monterio's body parts were stored in containers. She had given birth to a baby girl at a Kansas City motel last year and took her life shortly afterwards, according to Ray. Ray purposefully did not call the emergency services and instead chopped up her body in the bathtub because he was scared the authorities would take away his 2 daughters. That's a strange leap of logic right there, Tim.
Yeah, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
I think we need a new audio clip for that. Strange leap of logic, 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 logic. That is a very strange leap of logic. Well, she took her own life after giving birth. So that's postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm.
Understandable.
Mm-hmm.
And her taking her own life, I better chop her up and put her into containers and hide her in a storage shed so they don't try to take my kids away.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
No.
Jessica's sister said her brother-in-law spent 8 hours dismembering Jessica's body before stuffing it in a fridge. Last October, police found Ray with his newborn baby girl and 2-year-old daughter staying at a storage locker. One officer said that the older girl almost looked like she had cancer. He was arrested and the kids were swiftly taken into police custody. Police Detective Shannon Murphy testified that Ray had the kids pose for photos with Jessica's body. He then told her he skinned her like a fish.
Oh.
Ray then told Murphy he put the body parts that would not flush down the toilet into containers.
Oh.
During his preliminary hearing, Ray said, "It's something I had to do. My family is very dear to me. It's something I had to do to protect my family." You know, Tim, I'm going to go on the record here as a father of 8 million children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I must be remiss in my duties because that just would have never crossed my mind as a way to, I don't know, keep my family together.
Mm.
I don't I don't know. Maybe I'm old fashioned, Tim. I would have just thought that, you know, counseling and conversation would have been the best way to keep us together. And God forbid something happened to my wife during childbirth. Again, I don't know how I wouldn't have jumped to that conclusion, Tim, that, you know what, the best thing to do is just chop her up and put her in cans around the house. Maybe it's me. Maybe it's my brain that's not working, Tim. Help me understand. Am I the broken one here?
Well, no, I mean...
Okay, good.
No, you know, I mean, I think logically you probably would have called the proper authorities and you probably would have said, hey, you know what, we have a small issue here. But evidently in his little world, there was probably plenty of Folgers cans or storage bins or something sitting around that he had lying around that he needed to use anyways.
So it was like an art project.
Yeah, it was like a where's mommy project, let's see if we can find mommy in multiple places type deal.
This is horrible. And, horrible yeah. Parenting, Tim. Let me go on the record of saying I think personally that's not setting a good example for your children.
Well, probably not. No.
A millionaire accused of killing his lawyer just a week after judgment, Tim.
Ooh.
Millionaire David Youngerman should be enjoying his golden years. Instead, his assets are now under the control of police in Kansas City who've charged him with murder. Mm. It's something of a tale, per the Kansas City Star. The 80-year-old is accused of shooting and killing attorney Tom Pickert a week after Pickert won a $5.75 million judgment against Youngerman in October of 2017. Youngerman had been accused of shooting Pickert's client, a homeless man. Youngerman said was trying to steal copper from his business. Youngerman was also accused of shooting three others for the same reason within the same month's time in 2012, though he claimed self-defense and wasn't charged. It's good to be a millionaire, Tim. Apparently, you can just shoot people and most likely homeless people or ne'er-do-wells that are stealing copper and get away with it. In March, Youngerman was charged with shooting at yet another man who he said was trying to steal metal pipes from his company. Pickert's family has now filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Youngerman, and a Jackson County judge has placed $33 million in assets under the care of attorney Leland Shuren, who sits on the Kansas City Board of Police Commissioners. Youngerman's attorney, Nicole Forsyth, said that that's as un-American as you can get. Forsyth argues that Shuren's post is a conflict of interest, but Shuren says he works solely in a legal capacity and had nothing to do with charging or investigating Youngerman. The Star notes that Shuren's duties on the board do include overseeing police department operations, including personal matters. The paper also reports that while the $5.75 million judgment against him was in the works, Youngerman allegedly tried to move assets around, including transferring property into his daughter's name, as well as making bank withdrawals and transfers worth about, you know, $10 million or so, Tim. That's all.
Oh, well, that's
just
it.
Shuffling around $10 million. I mean, we do that on a weekly basis on this show.
Sure.
Yeah, we don't.
No.
We don't. We wouldn't. I wouldn't know what $10 million look like, Tim.
I do in Monopoly money.
Do you?
Yeah.
I don't. I'm not even that good at Monopoly.
Huh. Well, it takes some skill.
Huh.
Yeah.
A ranting man, Tim, has been arrested.
A ranting man?
A ranting man. Hmm. After a truck crashes into a Dallas TV station. Michael Chadwick Fry. Sounds like a very fancy name. Please welcome Michael Chadwick Fry. Sounds like he'd be performing at the Bellagio, not slamming his truck into a Dallas TV station.
I'm willing to bet he does community theater.
He's accused of slamming his pickup truck into a Fox affiliate station. I guess he was trying to break into the business, Tim.
He was trying to break into the business,
but he was yelling about high treason.
Ah, yes.
Dallas police arrested a ranting man who they say repeatedly rammed his pickup truck into the building of a Fox-affiliated television station during a live newscast on Wednesday morning. Police said Michael Chadwick Fry, age 34, was charged with second-degree criminal mischief, a felony, after he slammed his truck into the windows near the entrance of KDFW-TV and hurled a stack of papers onto the street and sidewalks downtown about 6 a.m. That's 7 a.m. on Eastern time, Tim. News anchors who stayed on the air through the newscast despite the crash said nobody was hurt. It wasn't immediately clear what led to the bizarre display. I'm going to guess maybe drugs or alcohol in there somewhere, Tim?
Maybe.
But Dallas Police Major Max Guerin said the man had mental issues and indicated people are trying to kill him. The incident heightened fears of violence at news outlets following the fatal shooting in June of 5 people at the Capital Gazette newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland. But Guerin said on Twitter, this incident does not appear to be an attack motivated against the media. KDFW posted details on Facebook showing photos of the front of the vehicle and damage to the building. The woman or the man was unable to enter the station and he was arrested at the scene, police said. Anchor and reporter Brandon Todd, who witnessed the man pacing outside the station before he was arrested, said that the man was yelling about high treason and that he believed he had clearly been wronged and that someone was trying to kill him. The man started crying when police took him into custody, Todd added. It's not real clear to what his message was, Todd said. The police bomb unit was called to the scene after the suspect removed a bag from his vehicle. No suspicious devices were found. Police said Fry intentionally crashed into the building several times. The papers littering the street referred to an officer-involved shooting in another city in 2012. Also, it's good to know that they're 6-year-old files still sitting on a desk, Tim. NBC Dallas-Fort Worth reported at the time that Fry was a passenger in a car driven by Roberto Carlos Hernandez, who allegedly put the car into reverse and rammed into a Denton County Sheriff's Patrol vehicle. The deputy shot Hernandez, who later died, the station reported. Court records show that a man of the same name and birth date has been arrested more than 24 times in Denton County since 2003, most of them on minor drug or alcohol-related charges. In 2003, he pled no contest to assault causing bodily injury and was sentenced to 110 days in jail. Details of that incident weren't immediately available to us, Tim. Interesting. Tim, there's been an assault in a Walmart. I know what you're saying. Dave, how can that be?
How unusual.
Maybe Target, Tim, not Walmart.
Yeah.
Not the higher echelon of Walmart.
You just brought up a very good question.
What is that, Tim?
Why are there no, I mean, especially
Target crimes?
Yeah, especially.
I don't know. Maybe they have a better press PR person.
A slew of Target assaults. Why are there not a slew of Target crimes?
Because Target's a little bit higher class, Tim.
What? Do we know that for sure?
A little bit. Yeah, their prices seem to be a little higher than Walmart. I could be wrong. Maybe I'll get whacked by Target for trying to say that online. I don't know. But an assault in a Walmart diaper aisle ends with a victim beating an attacker with his own gun. A South Carolina Walmart employee turned the tables on an alleged attacker in the diaper aisle by taking the man's gun away from him and repeatedly smacking him over the head with it, reported TV station WCBD and others news outlets. The jail mugshot of suspect Deshaud Ali Gordine, 25, of Georgetown, says he sustained significant injuries with bandages covering the side of his head. The incident took place on August 30th at the Walmart at Center Point Drive in North Charleston. The investigators say the victim reported he was working in the store when three men walked up to him shortly before 9 p.m. and one began punching him as the other stood by, reported WCSC. When the attacker allegedly pulled a pistol, the victim made a grab for it and the two began fighting, the station reported. The victim was able to get the gun and then began to pistol whip him, Tim, hit the suspect in the head multiple times with it, reported WCIV. All three suspects then fled the store, leaving behind the gun and a cell phone, the station reported. Police found Gordane later that night when he went to a hospital for treatment of his head wounds, reported WCSC. Do you think you could see the reverse Smith & Wesson logo on his forehead?
Oh, God.
Gordine is charged with unlawful carrying a weapon, kidnapping, possession of a weapon during a violent crime and assault and battery, according to jail records. Bond was set at $160,000, according to the jail website. All right, I don't understand the kidnapping. Although, did you know, and I think you do, I think you're the one that told me this, if somebody walked into the store you and I were working at, held us up and made us go into the back room, it becomes kidnapping. If they move us from one location to another, that's then kidnapping.
Yeah. Yep.
I didn't know that. That's crazy.
Yep.
It's good. But here's the deal. All right, Tim, you and your two thug hoodlum friends decide they're just going to go in and kick the crap out of some unsuspecting Target worker. So what's more humiliating, that you are kicking the snot out of somebody who then gets the upper hand, grabs your gun, and doesn't even give you the proper ending you should have, which is a good clean shot between the eyes, zombie style.
Hmm.
Instead, he just takes the gun and beats the shit out of you with it, Tim.
Okay.
Doesn't even use the gun as you were going to use the gun on him. This guy pulled the gun to shoot this Target employee. Target employee gets all like Jackie Chan on his ass, Tim. Snags the gun out of his hand and just keeps clubbing him with it. That's got to be kind of humiliating. And it's funny that it took place in a diaper aisle, because the photo, this guy has a huge bandage on his head and it totally looks like his head is wrapped in a diaper.
Hmm.
Yeah. Got his ass handed to him in a Target diaper aisle, and he had the gun to begin with.
Hmm.
You might want to just give up, Tim, being a hardened criminal if that's the case.
Yeah.
Hey, Tim, we're going to Roanoke, Virginia. I hope you're dressed for it.
I am, actually.
Try walking a mile in these shoes, Tim. That's how the clever article begins. A Virginia shoe store lost mostly shoes designed for the right foot over the course of two break-ins this summer, the Roanoke Times has reported. Clean Soles operator Rob Wickham says his two-year-old sneaker store was raided by two people July 20th and one person on August 25th. Taken together, he lost shirts, hoodies, a jacket, one complete sneaker pair, and 13 right shoes, Tim.
Hmm.
And apparently they were trying to get off on the right foot.
Oh, no, Dave. No. No. No.
Wickham says he typically keeps right shoes on display because you don't want to sell the wrong ones.
No, no, Dave. No.
The rest's are behind the counter, according to Wickham, says the looters were pretty much risking their freedom for nothing. I'll be the judge of that. Roanoke County Police spokeswoman Amy Whitaker says one 17-year-old has been charged in the July burglary. Police have also released video of the August 25th burglary, Tim.
Hmm.
And I'm pretty sure it's Alec Baldwin.
Really?
Wearing, looking like a skater boy. No. I could be wrong. Well, I'm not always good at this. That's why eyewitness accounts are not always good testimony, Tim, as I just proved.
Hmm. I kind of look forward to that, actually.
We're going to Washington, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
To KABC reporting a road rage incident that turned violent in Washington, D.C., Tim, as a woman got out of her vehicle and attacked a bus with a car jack. That's some balls right there, Tim. That's kind of grabbing the gun away from the perpetrator, beating him with his own gun balls, huh. Right? When you take on a bus with nothing but a tire iron and some scrappy a can-do attitude. So, you know, I think that's the same chutzpah that got Custer in trouble, Tim.
I don't know about that.
The violence took place Thursday afternoon in the 1800 block of Bladensburg Road, Northeast. The majority of the rage-filled incident was captured on cell phone video. Authorities identified the woman as 20-year-old Mariva Silver. Mariana Silver, Tim, there not Mariva.
Go. Yeah.
Mariva, I'm sorry to have brought you into this.
Yeah.
Mariva Silver is not involved.
No.
They said she was trying to illegally pass a bus and sideswiped another vehicle in the process.
Oof.
When the bus driver tried to make contact with her, the woman became irate and violent, Tim.
Of course.
In the video, she is seen using what appears to be a car jack. It's not like she grabbed a guy who was carjacking someone and beat the bus with it, Tim. I think they mean like a tire iron, jack from your car.
Right.
She grabbed from her trunk to smash the driver's side window and knock off the side mirror.
Hmm.
As she's doing that, another woman is seen in the center median of the on the phone, possibly calling the popo, Tim.
Uh-oh.
After Silver is done causing damage, she throws the jack back. Into a car and gets into the car, Tim.
Is that some Steely Dan you were saying?
Yeah, I know. I'm giving you a little bit of the... Yeah. But as she's about to leave, a man is standing in front of it in an attempt to stop her, as she appears to also be on the phone with the police. All right, so now this guy's got really big cojones, Tim, or a death wish. Because you just saw a woman sideswipe a car, then get out and attack a bus. And then you're going to go stand in front of her vehicle. I'm thinking this is the kind of woman that just doesn't have a problem gunning the engine.
Probably not, no. Mm-mm.
So you, again, death wish or insanely brave or a strange visitor from another planet with abilities far beyond those of mortal men, Tim.
We couldn't just go with Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, number four.
Which one? Both of them? Yeah.
Yeah.
And guess what she did, Tim? Do you think she finally had calmed down? She realized, this is where I stop. This is where I draw the line. I'll get out and I'll club an innocent bust, Tim, but I'm not going to run over a man.
No.
Yep, you're right. She revved her vehicle forward, which caused the man to fall onto her hood.
Yeah.
And a TJ Hooker style, Tim. There's a random reference that only 8% of our audience will get. Mm-hmm. Silver then, well, who's a hooker and why is her name TJ? Silver then gets out of her vehicle and attempts to pull the man away. The people on the bus go round and round, Tim. Round and round, round and round. The people on the bus, they go round and round, Tim.
Especially if you hit them right.
Yeah, the people on the bus then got out and ran over to the man, as well as other witnesses in the area. Well, that's nice. They all stepped up and got together. It was like the end of an 80s movie, Tim, as they all surrounded him as he was about to meet his untimely demise. As he was about to be jacked off by this woman, Tim.
What?
She had the car jack in her hand. She was about to jack him off right there.
Oh, God.
Just off somebody with a jack. What else is it called, Tim?
Well...
Right? How did he die? He was jacked off right in the middle of the street.
That would be a better way to go, I think.
Really? Getting nailed in the noggin with a jack, Tim?
Not that way.
Is that the way you want to go? Do you want me to jack you up when you die, Tim? That's what I'm asking.
Well,
because if you're dying slowly and you think, you know what? I can't take it anymore, Dave. Go get the car jack and jack me off. You know I'm the guy that'll do it, Tim.
Well,
hey, wait a minute. That didn't sound right, did it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, it might be a decent way to go, but that's...
God. Take a long time to do that, too, I would guess.
About a minute and a half.
Oh,
you're
really?
Doing it right.
Oh. What if I spit? Anyway, in her final attempt, she drives off despite the man falling onto her hood, and he ends up flying into the middle of the intersection as witnesses scream. The man recorded the video, and the bystander who tried to help ran over to the man to make sure he was okay. They all walked back to the bus, Tim.
They what?
They all whacked back to the bus. Huh. They walked. Authorities said the bus driver was okay and dropped off all the passengers at their stops despite the harrowing situation, Tim. So they all got off the bus eventually, Tim. They all got off. You remember that now.
They all got off?
At the end of the night, nobody was truly harmed. They all got off.
Well, good for all of them.
You're witnessing somebody getting jacked off right in the middle of the street, Tim. A brutal carjacking attack thing.
And then Canada paid for all their PTSD, right? All their,
yeah.
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 That's wild. It's wild and crazy stuff, Tim. All right. In our final two stories, Tim.
Yes.
We're going to go to East Tennessee, where a woman drove drunk on her way to jail. And she now has her license revoked for how many years, Tim?
20.
I'll give you a little bit more. A Kingsport woman pled guilty to driving drunk while on her way to jail to serve time for a previous DUI conviction. That's what CBS affiliate WJHL has reported. In October 2017, Scott County deputies pulled over Rachel Eves after someone reported a white pickup truck nearly hitting a guardrail multiple times on U.S. 23. Officials reported smelling alcohol, Tim.
Hmm.
And found the empty whiskey bottles on the floorboard.
Plural.
Eves told deputies she was drunk, and a breath test revealed her blood alcohol content was nearly 3 times the legal limit.
Boy.
She had been on her way to the Duffield Regional Jail to serve 30 days for a previous DUI conviction. That's conviction right there, Tim, to just get as loaded as you can on your way in to face a conviction.
Well, one last nip before you go in, yeah.
I think that's more than a nip, son. That was more of a tug. Eves was arrested and charged with felony driving under the influence, which is her third DUI in 5 years. All right, so kick off your shoes, start doing the math, Tim, according to Scott County's attorney. In January, while on bond for her third DUI, and on the day she was released from jail for the second DUI, Eves was again arrested for driving under the influence in Hawkins County.
Mm-hmm.
Eves was driving with her then 4-year-old child in the back seat when Hawkins County deputies pulled her over. In May, WJHL reported that she pleaded guilty in Scott County to the third DUI. During a sentencing hearing in July, Eves admitted to doing meth and drinking liquor and beer prior to her court appearance. The judge sent her to jail. revoked her bond, and rescheduled her hearing. On August 31st, the judge sentenced Eve to serve 1 year and 6 months in prison, pay a $1,000 fine, and her driver's license has been revoked for how many years, Tim? I've given you enough time to marinate on this story. I've given you all the information there is to give. There's not one more word left in this article except for the fact that WJHL reported it, Tim. How many years was her driver's license revoked for?
Well, earlier I joked that it was her 20 years, but I'll say five.
5 years, Tim.
Yeah.
5 years?
Yeah.
I'm going to give you one more chance. You were closer with 20, Tim. Closer with 20.
All right, 10 years.
99
what?
Years, Tim.
No way.
Wasn't that a song in the 60s? 99 years?
I think you're thinking of that years. Jay-Z song. She had 99 problems, but a license ain't one.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah. Well played. A Florida woman's, we knew Florida was coming up eventually, Tim.
Yep.
And to round out today's festivities, a Florida woman's home was shot up after she left a negative Facebook review about a restaurant, Tim.
Oh, of course.
See, this is why you got to be careful on social media. You're not always incognito, Tim. You're not always anonymous.
I'm not.
No.
Oh.
A Florida man was arrested Thursday evening, 10 days after he allegedly shot up a home after one of its residents complained about an experience at a restaurant, the Orange County Sheriff's Office said. On August 20th, deputies were called to a home about Norman Avul, age 42, of the Orlando area, Tim.
Hmm.
The House of Mouse, riding in an SUV driven by Michael Johnson, Tim.
Hmm.
Restaurant owner's son shot the home 3 times before Johnson drove away, according to an arrest report. I'm going to go out on a limb here, Tim, and say somebody's got anger issues. The report said one of the bullets pierced a window, narrowly missing the head of Kenneth Whaley, who was watching television in the living room. I actually could feel the air from the bullet as it passed by me, Wally said. It missed me by about 4 inches.
Ooh.
On August 19th, Whaley's wife, Diana Whaley, had been denied service at the Daybreak Diner. So their daughter, Monica Whaley, called the diner and spoke with several workers about her mother's visit, the report said. Monica Whaley said that she left a negative review on Facebook after her disabled mother was denied service on her birthday. She said the restaurant workers were unnecessarily rude. Well, that's to say the least, Tim. They've gone beyond unnecessarily rude when they follow you home and shoot at your house.
Yeah.
It's right to be able to tell others what my experience is and what happened and stand up for my mother, Monica Whaley said. I think that anybody in my shoes would have done the same thing. According to the report, Monica Whaley was unsatisfied with the diner's response, so she launched a social media campaign against the diner, alleging that they mistreated her mother because of a disability. The social media campaign resulted in a negative online review, negative social media posts, and harassing and angry phone calls to the restaurant, the report said. The restaurant's owner, Lizbeth Johnson, later stated that she felt that the day her business was ruined as a result of the negative social media campaign. Yeah, so let's try to put a positive PR spin on it and just go shoot the house up of the person, Tim. Maybe there'd have been a better way to bring her in and give her like lunch for life for the disabled mom. What do you think?
Oh yeah, that would
have been. Might that have been a better way and say, you know what, everybody has a bad day.
Yeah.
And we don't ever want you to have another bad day, so we would like to give you lunch for life.
Wow.
On our senior menu.
Yeah.
That would have been a way to turn that thing around. And take ownership. Hey, we made a mistake. Oops, I made a mistake. That's all. Making mistakes is never fun. I said, oops, I made a mistake. That's all. Remember that from Sesame Street, Tim?
Yeah.
Huh. Investigator said that Michael Johnson and his girlfriend, Stephanie Knight, worked at the diner that they intended to inherit someday, Tim. The report said Knight and Michael Johnson had been driving a 2013 white Ford Flex registered to Knight's father, David Knight. The K is silent. You read it your way. I'll read it mine. If there's a K, goddammit, I'm going to read it, Tim. The SUV matched the description of the one recorded by a surveillance camera approaching and the shooting scene, the report said. Investigators said Michael Johnson and Jesse Martin told them that on August 20th, they were drinking beer with Avil at the home where they all live. Deputies said the men were angry about the damage to the diner's reputation and the negative social media campaign. So Martin used an internet search engine to determine Monica Whaley's identity from her Facebook post and to find her address. Michael Johnson then drove the white Ford Flex, and Martin navigated from the back passenger seat, and Avil rode in the front passenger seat. The report said there will be a test, Tim. I hope you remember where everybody's sitting. Michael Johnson and Martin contend they drove to the Whaley residence with the intent to harm someone via physical fight or to cause property damage, slashing tires, or similar vandalism. Deputies say Avil fired the shots when Michael Johnson stopped outside the home. Investigators said the men tried to dispose of the evidence after Michael Johnson drove away. Avil was arrested Thursday at South Bumby Avenue and Nancy Street near the Lake Como home where the three men live. Mo, Larry, and Curly. Detective said Avil expressed loyalty to Michael Johnson and Knight and said he had drunk 6 to 8 beers with his friends while discussing the issue and before going for a ride with Michael Johnson and Martin. Investigators said that although Avil wouldn't discuss his involvement in the incident, he told them that he understands that it might have looked bad for him. Thank you, Captain Understatement. Avil, who was honorably discharged from the United States Army, said he drinks beer most days. Both Martin and Michael Johnson expressed concern for their safety and stated that they had witnessed or been subjected to violent outbursts by Avil in their residence, the report said. Avil was arrested on charges of shooting into an occupied dwelling, shooting from a vehicle within 1,000 feet of a person, and abuse of a disabled adult. I don't think anybody was crazy enough to do something like this over something so small, Monica Whaley said. Well, you were wrong, Monica Whaley. You were dead wrong.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Very.
Yeah. You know what? Instead of taking the law into your own hands, why don't you take them to court? The People's Court. Dun-dun. Dun-dun-dun-dun. Obscure reference number 18, brought to you by Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law. I don't know, Tim. A lot of messed up people out there. A lot of dumb stuff going on.
Yeah, negative review isn't worth gunshots in the home. Just
no.
No.
All right. Well, that's it. I am off next week, Tim. I am off. I will be in Romania in search of Vlad Tepes, Dracula, Tim. So I won't be here, but you'll be here. You'll have more true crimes, more dumb crimes, stupid criminals next week right here on the best in true crime talk radio. For that guy and this guy, you've been listening to that show, the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday.